hello. Welcome to the Ethos of Aid podcast. My name is Kimber, and I'm your host. Thanks so much for listening. In this episode, why process is important, and how 28 pastoralists turned health workers made a difference to women and their babies in southern Ethiopia. All that and more. Let's get started. Today, I'll start by sharing that I've been lovingly laughing at myself since I hit publish on episode one. There was a lot left on the cutting room floor, to be honest. Part of that is me learning to podcast, and a part of that is me learning how not to cram every point I want to make into a single episode. Writers, please chuckle along with me right here. I'm also aware I got a little preachy. It's never my intention. I do have observations about the systems in which I work, and I'm passionate about investing in practitioners doing the heavy lifting. So sometimes the line between sharing validated learning and shining a light on flaws in the system gets a little blurry. I'll try to keep that in check. And for any of you listening, I want to say up front, I will be sharing my learning process in this new medium. I do so as an invitation to all of us to get more comfortable with process and mess and growth and learning in general. I simply won't pretend that I've got this all figured out because I don't, and that wouldn't be authentic. And as I said in episode one, let's meet in the real. It's really the only place I want to live. A friend said to me recently, I want to be inspired not only by your experiences, but by your process of learning to share them in this new way. Don't we all want to know that when we step off the cliff into the unknown, we are held? Yes, we do. Thank you, Pam Jones. This is vulnerable work, and sharing this work in podcast form is equally vulnerable. And yet I know it's what I'm meant to do right now. So thank you, Brené Brown. I forge ahead with my current favorite quote of yours in my back pocket. It goes like this. I belong to and believe in myself so deeply that I can share my authentic self with the world, feeling both a part of it and capable of standing alone in the wilderness. Amen, sister. I love my work because it is a continual process of reflection, growth, and expansion, so sharing it is in harmony with the intention of this podcast. And specifically, it speaks to the fact that the work I do is process work. It's the human process work that's essential to every program, yet rarely included in our proposals and log frames because it doesn't fit easily within outcome-driven systems. So part of the purpose of this podcast then is to make more of that process work visible, apparent, included. Because to serve recipients of humanitarian aid well and ethically, in my opinion, human service practitioners of all kinds need knowledge, skills, and self-awareness. And since we can't assume that all practitioners in every context have had human service training, for me, doing so becomes a part of the work. I honor the knowledge, skills, and awareness that exist and seek out the ways I can support learning and growth. Something I hope every practitioner is committed to. And since, as an international practitioner, I'm always leading or supporting a team of local practitioners in their contexts, I am by nature engaged in cross-cultural leadership, which in my perspective requires a very specific skill set beyond thematic expertise. With those teams, we are learning about the work together while doing the work together while learning from one another. I need to make sure I'm not imposing my beliefs, values, and norms. To do that, I need to know my own social location. If you listened to episode one, you might have heard me mention the concept of social location and its relevance to this work because of all the humans who come together from different places to do it. Social location encompasses and is drawn from the life experiences, beliefs, values, ethics, social, cultural, and religious norms, histories, and systems in which a person was raised, and which create the perspective or lens through which they see and interact with the world. For example, I am a 50-year-old woman in a white body, from Canada, and of English and Dutch descent. In terms of ancestry, it doesn't get much more colonial than that. And my parents and their parents were raised in the time where white supremacy was not questioned or held to account or invited to look deeply at itself. I have been in a continual unlearning process from these origins since becoming aware of them around the age of 25. There are many other factors that make up how I see and engage with people in the world. These are just a few. But knowing them allows me to see my origins, choose what I believe as an adult, as a practitioner, and meet people as they are, where they are, and honor their social location. I learned that where I have impact is outside my culture of origin, creating spaces where people feel safe enough to explore themselves, their beliefs, their work, space to think, to grapple, to listen, discuss, and consider holding perspectives other than the one they're currently holding. In my experience, this is the first and most vital increment in human change processes. In my work, it's one conversation at a time, one moment at a time, sometimes one word at a time. I'm going to share a story with you now, and as you listen, I invite you to notice and reflect on what comes up for you. What feelings are evoked? What thoughts do you have? What gets activated? And how is it connected to your way of seeing yourself and the world around you? If you're enjoying what you're listening to, I would love to hear about it. Or if you have a story you'd like to share, or you'd like to be a guest, please do let me know, either at kimbervredenburg.com by hitting the contact button, or on the Ethos of Aid Facebook page, or at kimbervredenburg on Instagram. Okay, enough with the adverts. Let's get back to that narrative. Today, we are going to Ethiopia, East Africa. And we're zooming right in and going down to the Gambela region. Ethiopia is a stunning place, inhabited by some of the most generous people I've had the honor of knowing. For some, it's considered the birthplace of civilization. At the time I arrived, there was an emergency occurring due to conflict in neighboring South Sudan. It resulted in several hundred thousand people taking refuge in southern Ethiopia, most of whom were women and children. The refugee camp was built in a floodplain, and it rained often. The tents and pit latrines were floating. The communal structures that had been built were surrounded by vast pools of stagnant water, in which elaborate ramps and walkways had been fashioned out of whatever wood and metal materials could be found. And it was hot. There were very few dry areas in the whole camp. The emergency had been going on for months. And at the time I arrived, the practitioners on the ground felt it was relentless. The NGO I was working for was implementing a therapeutic feeding program for malnourished children under the age of 2, alongside a mental health and care practices component for their mothers. I was hired to support these programs as they navigated the next phase of the emergency. What was supposed to happen was that health workers would first follow protocols and measure the baby's weight for height to determine if malnutrition was present and dispense therapeutic or supplemental feeding. This is standard practice. Then those health workers would direct the babies and their mothers to the mental health and care practices program, where mothers could rest, breastfeed, and have conversations with program staff while their children played. The health workers, prior to their training in how to practice this work, were themselves pastoralists, sheep farmers and cattle farmers, as their fathers had been for generations in the land around the camp. These were some of the local practitioners. While they had received some training, they were due for more, according to the plan that had been devised by the NGO in the capital, Addis Ababa, and in Paris, France, where the NGO originated. While these plans and trainings drew on extensive research, they are still largely created outside of contexts such as Ethiopia. I was asked to deliver a second training for these health workers, and specifically because, as it happened, they were not in fact directing the mothers and their babies to the mental health and care practices part of the program. I discussed this with the head of mental health and care practices in Addis and Paris and shared my observations that there was more going on that contributed to the blockage and that perhaps another information-based training was not in fact what was needed. Intuitively, I knew that there was a chasm between the beliefs from outside context and those from inside. But there was no buy-in at headquarters. I was to deliver the training as it had been designed. Now, I am someone who follows the rules until they don't make sense. And in this case, that directive did not make sense. This is an example of how things work, though. Plans are made with good intentions and research, but far enough outside of context not to be able to connect with what's happening on the ground day to day. And honestly speaking, field staff simply aren't as valued as headquarters staff. That's been my experience across a number of NGOs. As for myself, I'm a facilitator of collective learning. So I use whatever I observe is happening in programs as opportunities for learning for everyone involved. That means I design and deliver training and workshops in the field with practitioners that align with context and that go beyond standard information-based training. So let me paint the next part of the picture. I love this part. 28 pastoralists turned health workers stroll languidly into the great plastic shelter. The heat and humidity are stifling, and I'm already sweating through my clothes. It's not a complaint. I actually love it. There are mats along the wall that are as dry as they are ever likely to be in a flooded camp. And each of these staff selects a spot in the wide circle. I have always loved watching scenes like this because of the easy affection shown for one another as the men sit very closely together, some holding one another's hands in friendship and solidarity, quietly laughing together. It's really beautiful. I begin as I always do, by learning everyone's names. I go round and round in groups of six or seven, and I don't stop until I can correctly pronounce every single person's name from start of the circle to finish. It's not only a great icebreaker and party trick, it's vital. Names are important, however challenging they are to pronounce. This seemingly small act conveys genuine caring, which I do, and it's rewarded with trust. It's also hilarious as I wrap my Canadian tongue around consonants not typically put together in my vernacular and mispronounce them left, right, and center. And I don't mind one bit being laughed at in the process by an entire room full of people in this way. I truly feel free to be my whole self in places like this. Once that's taken care of and the energy's high in the room, I hand out paper and crayons to more laughter and hilarity, for it's rare for these grown men to get to play with crayons and paper in their days. And I ask them to reflect on a time in their lives when they felt cared about. A time when someone they knew did something that showed them care, whatever that meant or looked like for them. I take a page and crayon for myself, because I do believe it's unethical to ask anyone to do something I'm not willing to do myself. I will share my perceptions here as well. In the 15 or so minutes that ensue, what begins as giggles grows into raucous laughter and finger pointing at what is emerging on each other's pages. It's marvelous. When the laughter subsides, I ask for brave souls to share. What flows out are stories of fathers who taught them to care for their goats because the goat cares for them, or mothers who planted trees so the children could have shade to play in, or teachers who recognized their talents and paid their school fees when their parents could not. With each narrative shared, I ask, what parts of you felt cared for? My mind, my heart, my brain, they say. I ask them to think about the mothers and their babies in the program. Is it possible they and their children need this kind of caring? Of course, they bellow. I laugh. We all laugh. And as the realization slowly dawns, my favorite sound emerges. All these practitioners needed was an experience of emotional resonance from their own lives and culture to connect to the concept of mental health and care practices. And not only to connect to the concept, but to work through the stigma around those words. Stigma is rooted in fear, and it is extraordinarily present and powerful in the contexts where I work. This is what the mental health and care practices part of the program is providing for those mothers and babies, I say. Mental health is not something we understand well here, so there is stigma, they say. These words, mental health, are reserved for the crazy people, they tell me. And I concur. Sadly, it's still the same in much of the world. But really, I say, it's just a way of acknowledging that we are more than our bodies. We are our minds and hearts and spirits, and we need care in all of those parts. We went on to discuss the specifics of how the mothers and babies benefit from the program, but the critical shift had already taken place in what felt like a single moment, in a safe, fun, respectful moment. Those pastoralists turned health workers went from blocking the flow of the program to actively promoting it and promoting the mental health and care practices program. They had all they needed within them. All that was necessary was to draw it out, to show them caring, to provide an opportunity to connect with their own cultural life experiences and create emotional resonance with these concepts that carried fear and stigma with them. And it didn't take long. It took an afternoon, and it was fun. As a practitioner, do you use these approaches? And if you're outside of this work, what questions are coming up? This really was a microscopic view of one moment of training in a humanitarian emergency. What happens when your lens zooms back out, I wonder? To me, experiential learning approaches like this one are easy, and they're ultimately respectful of the practitioners and their social locations and the contexts in which humanitarian work is taking place. For over 20 years, I've been hired to manage or consult on programs created for women, children, and communities in difficult circumstances. Sometimes those communities are coping with HIV and AIDS, sometimes children orphaned due to religious extremism, or communities trying to heal and accept the return of former child combatants after conflict. This is big work at the individual level in the field. And the organizations I work for are informed and well-researched and staffed with professionals across all the thematic areas, from water and sanitation to health to education. And at the same time, they're not necessarily experts in human change processes or connecting the dots between policies and programs and the individuals impacted by them or expected to carry them out in the field, or aware of the importance of beliefs, values, social, cultural, and religious norms in facilitating these programs, or the need for the practitioners doing the work to be aware of those things in themselves and in context. I believe everyone has their own answers and that my role in their lives are only ever temporary. I'm there for the purpose of co-created learning, and for me that works best if I lead with transparency, respect, and integrity. I'm trained in human and social development, in therapeutic intervention, and child protection, and I have 20 years of experience in the field, and all of those things matter, but at the core, the reason I'm able to do what I do in the narrative I described is because I know who I am and what I believe. And because of that, I'm comfortable meeting people as they are, where they are, in what they believe, and helping each of us discover more about ourselves as we do the work together. That's what makes moments like the one I described in the narrative so beautiful. It wasn't me trying to teach those practitioners anything, but rather creating a space where they could become familiar with what they already knew. That's what this work is all about for me. Well, that's it for today. Thanks so much for listening. I really appreciate you being here, and I would love to know what you're thinking about now. Please do find me either at kimbervredenburg.com or on the Ethos of Aid Facebook page or at Kimber Vredenburg on Instagram. This really is a space for dialogue and sharing, and I can't wait to hear from you. Till next time.